just like Boaz saying, Hashem imachem. And in fact, even the concept that you respond in reverse, right? I say shalom aleichem, and you say aleichem shalom. The concept of reversing, although it's not explained why, is also built into this pasuk. Because what did Boaz say? Boaz said, Hashem imachem. And they said, Yivarechacha Hashem. Meaning to say, the initiator puts God's name first, and the respondent puts God's name second. That's exactly what we do. Shalom Aleichem. The name of God is the first word. When you answer Aleichem Shalom, the name of God is the second word. That's an exact parallel to Hashem Imachem, and they respond, Yivarechacha Hashem. According to the halacha, yes, although our custom is that we use shalom instead, because shalom is the name of God, but according to the strict... I wouldn't do it because the custom is not to do it, but according to the strict... When we say, the difference between by pronouncing it, I mean, you pronounce it, you don't pronounce the yud kei vav kei the way it's, like you never do, but you do pronounce it as aleph dalet, the way you would say it in a bracha. The custom is not to do it, I have to say, but nevertheless, according to the halacha, you are allowed to greet a person in the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the proof is from Boaz himself. Now, according to Chazal, when it says Boaz came from Beis Lechem, he was actually returning from the funeral of his wife. So it's very interesting. The first time Rus encounters Boaz, he is now an eligible bachelor. So it's all the rage. Because he'd be allowed to have two wives. Halachically, it would not have mattered, but presumably, as a matter of Boaz's interest being piqued, it would have mattered. In other words, had he been married, it's not likely he would even notice another woman. That's correct. Well, it would be relevant. I think our assumption here is that Boaz was not attracted to us because of lust, but he saw moral qualities in her. In fact, even in the field, he saw that she was gathering grain with modesty and the like. We'll point that out as we go further. Okay, and the next thing is Boaz says. So Boaz greets the harvesters, and then the next question is Boaz asks his youth and said, to whom does this young woman belong? In other words, so two things. He greets the harvesters, and then he sees a woman. So the Gemara asks, is it the derech of the distinguished Boaz to start asking, hey, you know, who's this woman? And especially he's coming back from his wife's funeral. You know, he can't wait a few days to be respectful. So Rashi points out that Boaz was immediately very, very surprised by the behavior of this woman as she was following after the harvesters. Keep in mind that there was no mechitza here, that presumably after any of the harvesters you had men and women, everybody's going together trying to fight for whatever they could get. So first of all, it points out that the position of Rus's body, that she would not bend over in any way that would cause her dress to be hike up or anything else. She comported herself specifically that she should not expose any part of her body. And the other thing, which is even a bigger Yetzirah, is she was very meticulous in not taking more than she was entitled to take. And this is very tricky, and it's a very difficult halacha to apply in practice. And that is, according to the strict halacha, if I'm a harvester and I hold a bunch of grain and I take the sickle and I cut it, if one or two grains fall beyond the sickle, the poor can take that. But if a third grain, if more than two fall per cut, everything above two belongs to the balabayit. Meaning to say, the poor, and that means all the poor, that doesn't mean each poor person gets two, but it means that per cut, only two stalks of grain are leket. Everything else is not leket. Now the truth of the matter is, most of the poor people who were not necessarily totally righteous really didn't care. Whatever was cut, they would grab. They wouldn't start cheshboning, the first two were already taken by somebody. But he saw that Rus was keeping a mental record. If two stalks were cut, or more than two were cut, And any time somebody took the first two, she would not take anything from that cut. By the way, I don't know how this applies when you have combines or harvesting machines. In other words, a combine can harvest a whole thing, a whole row. And the question is, do they only get two stalks of grain out of that row if it's like it? I'm not sure how it applies at all. But at least when you're dealing with a hand sickle, anything more than two belonged to the Bala Bayis. So he was extremely impressed that Rus would not allow herself to take more than what the halacha allots to the poor. So he immediately says, to whom, you'll notice he doesn't say what's her name, he says, to whom does this young woman belong? Because he's interested in her family, in her upbringing. In other words, how did she get such midos? And he gets the surprising answer, this is that Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the fields of Moab. So now Boaz says, oh, she's the one. Yeah, apparently he had not set eyes on Rus before. And Rus, now again, it's interesting. Boaz is talking to a guy, one of his servants, and Pasuk Zayin, Rus starts talking. So how did that happen? Presumably what happened was, Rus is nearby. She hears Boaz asking questions about her. So she turns to Boaz directly, and she says, please let me gather grain after the harvesters. I'm reading this wrong. Pasuk Zayin is not Rus talking to Boaz. Pasuk Zayin is a continuation of the speech of Boaz's servants. See how you read it? In other words, the Nar, the youth, is talking to Boaz and said, this is the Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the field of Moab, and, this is the servant talking, and she had said that she wants to gather grain following the harvesters, and, right, the servant is still talking, and she has come and she has stood in this field from the morning until now, the afternoon, and she is only going back, she only sat a little bit in the field, she took up a little rest time, and the like. Right? So this is the servant talking to Boaz, and now Boaz turns to Rus. Now, again, one would think this is very odd. You would think that Boaz would say, come to my house, be part of my house, etc. No, he makes her the following generous offer. He says to her, please do not go and glean in anyone else's field, and you should attach yourself with the young women that are gathering in my field. So basically what he's telling her is, I hereby give you the right, which of course she had anyway, to follow the gleaners in my field with everybody else, and do not go anywhere else. Again, it's peculiar. He's not really giving her anything here. He is simply telling her, stick around in my field, don't go anywhere else. Now the question is, that's still going to mean she's competing with all the poor people. That's still going to mean she's only entitled to two stalks per every cut of the sickle, and if anyone else takes those two stalks, there's nothing that she's entitled to. So as I indicated the other day, one of the kashas that the Mefarshim have is why is Boaz, as it were, so relatively ungenerous to Rus, knowing in particular that number one, he admires Rus's character and her honesty, and number two, he knows that Rus is the daughter-in-law of Naomi, which is his aunt, and shouldn't he be more charitable in that regard?
Could be that since she's still referred to as the Moabite woman, therefore she's not part of the Jewish people, mm-hmm. and only this law only applies to Jewish poor people, not
so in effect he's giving her a right that perhaps not everybody would recognize. Because if we assume the halacha is that female Moabites are considered regular Jews, but the halacha was not widely known, so perhaps Rus would have felt there'd be some discrimination, although she was already doing it before Boaz came on the field, but at least Boaz is now in effect telling his staff that she has the right to do it. Okay, of course that answers what is he giving her, but it still doesn't answer why wasn't he more generous. But again, presumably the issue would be that he ironically probably felt that this would preserve dignity, meaning to say, since the Torah says the poor have the right to this stuff, they didn't feel they were taking charity. They felt they were taking what they were entitled to do. They were co-workers in the harvest, in a way. As opposed to Boaz kind of just taking over, that would have been charity, that would have been humiliating, that would have been embarrassing. So here you see, at least indirectly, that one of the most important aspects of tzedakah is to give charity in a way that does not only take care of the economic needs of someone, but that respects their dignity and their self-sufficiency, right? The famous halacha of the Rambam, that the highest form of charity is when you give somebody the skill to have a job, give them a job. Because then they're earning it, and it's not something that's just being given to them that takes away the humiliation. What does it say? Give somebody a fish, you give them a meal. Teach somebody how to fish, you give them a life, right? That's kind of that difference. Okay. And then Boaz goes on and says, Einayich basadeh asher yiktzavun. Your eyes should be on the field. Oh yes, one other thing I want to point out though, that the Medrash makes a very interesting point. Boaz emphasizes, attach yourselves with my young women. Meaning to say that women, stick with the women. Now before the pasuk it said, but Ruth was following the harvesters, Kotzrim, which are the men. So the Medrash actually makes the point that in spite of Ruth's tzinias, it's very interesting, in spite of Ruth's great modesty, there were certain almost instinctual vestiges of Moabite character which came out almost subconsciously. Right? There is a concept that sometimes we don't totally escape our old selves, even though, you know, we're 99% out of there. And the Medrash actually comments the fact that Rus, without thinking, is following the men, in spite of the fact that she's modest and everything else, is a residual lingering effect of the degenerate Moabite culture. And Boaz is kind of giving her a gentle corrective by saying, oh, please stay, and, you know, the women are right here, and stay with the women. Okay. And then he offers her a second thing. He says, when you are thirsty, you can drink the water that my workers draw up for themselves. So this is a relatively minor concession, although if you're thirsty, it could be a bit important thing, where he gives her two rights. The right to follow the harvesters, which is a right the Torah gave her, but as you point out, maybe the idea was, since she was a Moabite woman, that needed to be stressed. But insofar as that right is concerned, that is no better than would be true for any poor person. And the second right is, when you're thirsty, you can go over to where my workers are drinking, and you will be you're given drinking rights, right? You're entitled to drink the water. Now, Rus is overwhelmed by this relatively minor kindness, we think, and it says, she fell on her face and she bowed down when she said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you recognize me with distinction? Anochi nochriya. I am a foreigner. Now, this is a very important word because this really tells us the depths of how much Rus did feel like an outsider. She was Jewish, she was halachically Jewish, but she was a Moabite. The Moabites were a hated nation, number one. She came without friends, she came without family other than her mother-in-law. She came from riches to poverty. And keep in mind that the halacha that most people understood, which was not the right halacha, is Moabite women don't really belong in the Jewish faith. And all of this is encapsulated in the concept of, I am a Nachri. I am an outsider. I am, of course, the word Nachri means goy, but really it's the idea of being an outsider, being excluded. Okay? In fact, it's interesting. This is one of the Hebrew words whose shayrish is actually the opposite. Hebrew has an interesting phenomenon, which you have in English to a very limited degree. For example, commencement can mean beginning, can mean end, although it's connected because the end of something is the beginning of something else. But in Hebrew, we have a phenomenon where certain roots can be both the normal shorish and the opposite. For example, lahashrish, right? Lahashrish can mean to plant, and it can mean to uproot. And the shorish is roots. Well, here, the word nechar, which means stranger or foreigner or goy, the shorish of nechar is hakir. Hakir is to be recognized or to recognize. Lahakir. So a nachri is one who is not recognized, one who does not have a place. It may be kind of a contraction, like ein hakir. There is no recognizing here. In other words, you're excluded. The nun comes from a word of negation, like ein or ayin. And the chafresh is part of the shoresh hakara. So ein, a person without hakara, without any type of recognition, is called a nachri. So it's not just a non-Jew, someone that is just foreign, someone who feels they don't belong. So this really gives us a sense of the depths of Rus's feeling to be an excluder, and how grateful she is that somebody. Remember, keep in mind that Rus does not know that Boaz is a relative. It doesn't say Naomi told her yet. But Rus has so much gratitude that somebody pays attention to her. This is also a big mussar that we see, you know. Let's say you're in a show. So there may not be any nachrim in the sense of goyim, right? But there are strangers. Faces, unfamiliar faces, unfamiliar people. People who don't feel that they belong. People who feel excluded or outside. And you see from this pasuk how much gratitude can well up within a person when they are recognized. Somebody just pays attention to them a little bit. And, particularly if you've been on both sides of that, right? If you've been on the side of being the Nachri, then when you're already established and you see others, one should remember that type of feeling and use it in a positive way. And now Boaz says, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Hageid hu gadli, it was told to me, Kol asher osis es chamosech, all that you have done for your mother-in-law. He still doesn't say he's a relative. He just says, I've heard all the good things you've done. Achere mosi sheikh, after your husband died. V'tazvi avich v'imeich, and you have forsaken your father and your mother in Moab. V'yeretz moladeteich, and the land of your birth. V'telchi elam, and you went to a new nation. Asher lo yadat tamol shilshon, that you didn't know yesterday and the day before yesterday. Meaning, I see the courage and the commitment that you made in your life. And therefore, Yeshalem Hashem po'alech, may God reward you for your pu'ulah, for your action. Uti maskurtech shalema, and may your reward be complete. From God, the God of Israel, Asher bas lechasos, tachas kenafa. This is one of the beautiful phrases. The God of Israel, to whom you have come to seek refuge under his wings. Okay, the imagery here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is described as a bird that protects its young by enveloping them with their wings. To this very day, when we write, of course there are different texts for this, but very often when we write a certificate of conversion for a non-Jew who's becoming Jewish, this pasuk is quoted, may your reward be great from the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Right? The concept of God protecting you. In fact, I think there's even a medrash that says that the ger who does not have a father and a mother in a halachic sense, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu is their father and mother. And as you know, there was a famous letter that Rambam wrote in a very irascible and angry tone, where apparently the question was, a non-Jew who converted, Rav Ovadia the Ger, was told that when he davened Shemona Esrei, he was not allowed to say, Elokeinu, our God, Velokei Avoseinu, and the God of our forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, because his forefathers were not Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So the rabbi of the synagogue was instructed the ger that when he davened Shemona Esrei, he should say Elokeinu Velokei Yisrael, or Elokei Avos Yisrael, the God of the fathers of Israel. So the Ger asked the Rambam, what should he do? So the Rambam wrote a very, very bitter, a critical letter about this rabbi, saying this rabbi is an ignoramus and he transgresses the 30 prohibitions in the Torah against embarrassing a Ger, etc. And the Rambam makes the point that even a non-Jew can say, Elokei Avoseinu, that God is the God of our forefathers, he says, because Avraham Avinu is the forefather of every person who turns to belief in Hashem. That Avraham is one's spiritual forefather, even if he is not the biological. The truth is, in spite of the Rambam's very strong letter, it's not so clear that that's the halacha, but the minhag is like the Rambam. Because the truth is, it's really a machlokes in the Mishnah. I mean, there is an opinion in the Mishnah that says Elokeinu of Elokei Yisrael. And there's also Hal Shaila, what does a ger say in the morning bracha? Shalo asani goy. Does a ger say he didn't, the ger was made a goy, he later became Jewish. So some say the ger should state the positive. Rechata Hashem Elokim Melech Olam, Sho'asani Yehudi. He made me a Jew. Meaning, I can't say he didn't make me a guy because I was born a guy, but I can say he made me a Jew by allowing me to convert. So there's a machlokas, what a ger says. Okay, so then Rus acknowledges with even greater humility, may I continue to find favor in your eyes, you have comforted me. Right, that's important. That implies that Rus did feel rejection until these words were said. You have given me nechama. V'chi dibarta alev shivchasecha. You have spoken to my heart. Again, what he's saying is your words comfort the sadness in my heart. V'anochi lo eya kiachas shivchasecha. Even though I am not as worthy as even one of your maidservants. So apparently, this softened Boaz's heart, so he offers her a third concession, right? So the first two haven't been that great. The first concession was she has the right to follow the poor people and pick up the grain. The second concession is she has a right to get a drink of water, not of soda, right? Just water, when she's thirsty. Okay. The third is he gives her the right to eat bread that's given to his workers. She can kind of join them for their meal. And Geshi Halom, come near. V'achalt min alechem, you can eat the bread that my staff is eating. In other words, and it doesn't come out of your allotment, meaning you don't have to use what you gathered for your meal. You'll get bread separately. V'tavalt pitech b'chometz, you can dip your bread in vinegar. Again, that doesn't sound tremendously appetizing, but that was a common food, that bread was dipped in some type of vinegar, and it was eaten. And she sat next to the harvesters. Again, it seems to be the male harvesters here. He handed her parched grain. So apparently this wasn't whole bread, but this was kernels of grain that are parched. If you ever had parched grain, you know that taking kernels of grain and roasting them over a fire, you get a very sweet cereal. A certain, almost a sweetness, a nutty sweetness, like granola, even without the sugar. Vatochal, vatisba, she ate, and she was satisfied. Vatosar, and there were extra. So apparently this is some extra. All right, so Bekitzer, once again, these are so far three concessions. Gather the grain, you have a right to drink water, you have a right to eat parched grain with the workers. And then we find that Boaz gave some hidden commands. And he said, Gam bein ha-morim tilaket, let her gather among the sheaves, for lo tachlimuho, and do not embarrass her or harass her. So what does that say? I mean, that already said that, everyone gathers among the sheep, among the... Now let's see. Does anyone have? I just want to see if there's one with Rashi. Sure.
You have that?
Just check it. Thank you. Yeah, this pasuk is a little difficult. It doesn't really say what additional thing he's giving her.
Maybe she could just take the leg, not
the leg. The actual sheaves. The question is this, though. The question is, would Rus do that? In other words, These psukim seem to indicate that he's giving some secret instruction to fool her into thinking she could take something. For example, the next pasuk says he tells the workers to deliberately drop things, that she'll think it's accidental. So it has to be something that, you know, that she'll think she has a right to take, even though it's deliberate. Unless he's instructing her not to push her around to make room for other people. What pasuk was this? This was pasuk Tesvav. Unless the only point is, don't embarrass her. Meaning, you could imagine a situation where the harvesters, I'm trying to cut grain, and I got 20 poor people standing around, letting me, take the knife, and I might just yell, "Get out of the way." So Boaz gave a special instruction: do not shame her or embarrass her. And the next thing he said was, and he told the workers, drop some extra stuff as you're cutting, even if it wouldn't have fallen, so Rus will have something to take. That's the Shol Tashola, drop extra things. Okay? Etc. And the pasuk says she spent the whole day there, it's hard work. And when she threshed what she had harvested, it was an ephah of barley. Now, let's think about what an ephah is, because an ephah is quite a lot of barley. I can tell you exactly how much it is. A tenth of an ephah is the amount of man that fell per day for every Jewish person. That is also the volume that was brought for the Omer. Now how much is that? So according to Chazal, that's the volume of 43 and a fifth eggs. Right? Imagine the volume, 43 and a fifth eggs. That's a tenth of an ephah. In fact, that's the amount of flour you need to be chayef to separate challah from dough. Same thing. So this was an ephah. This was 10 times that. This is the volume of 430 eggs. Now imagine eggs with the shell. Imagine if you had, how large of a pot would it take to put in 430 eggs? Pretty big pot. So she had a pot filled with, we're not including the stalks here, because it was after she threshed the grain. Right, so all she has are kernels of grain. She has a whole ephah, a basket, full of that barley corns that are equal in volume to not weight. It's a volume comparison, equal in volume to 430 eggs. So you see, it's a good day's work in the field. Now we don't know how much of it is because Boaz deliberately dropped stuff and everything else. But even so, I'm not sure how much she would gain, because if she was still following the halacha that she only got two stalks per cut, and there are still other poor people following, it takes a long time to get that much barley. So apparently there was a tremendous bracha here, that she was tremendously matzliach. And indeed, we are told that Naomi was astounded by the quantity that Ruth was able to bring home, because that could feed a family for quite a long time. Why did she carry it? Well, I don't know. It was also pretty heavy. Yeah.
Some of these cages, why didn't just give it to her?
Yeah, so again, that's a real question on this whole chapter. The only thing we could assume is that Boaz did not want to embarrass them by giving them charity. This is also charity, but apparently there was a sense that what the poor people gathered in the fields were their entitlements that the Torah gave them. So they considered that's what I'm entitled to get. They didn't look at that as charity. They worked for it, after all, they're following in the field. As opposed to the hospitality and everything else, that would have been somewhat humiliating. But again, it's a good, it's a difficult kasha. Okay, and now for the first time, Naomi asks Rus, where did you get all this stuff? And she said, oh, I was at this guy whose name is Boaz, not knowing that that's family. And Naomi says, Baruch Hashem, that Boaz is our relative. And for the first time, Naomi mentions, Mi go ale, this is verse 20, Mi go aleinu hu. He is our redeemer. In other words, a light bulb went off in Naomi's head, which did not go off before. Yeah, they're related this way. Again, Elimelech and Salmon. Salmon is Boaz's father. Were brothers. Both of them were the sons of the great Nachshon ben Aminadab, the tub of the tribe of Yehuda, who jumped into the Red Sea up to his neck. Right, the Red Sea. Now, Boaz is a son of Salmon. So Boaz is the nephew of Elimelech, and vis-a-vis Rissa's husband, Mahlon, Boaz and Mahlon are first cousins. Right? So Naomi has an idea here, which will be developed in chapter 3. Hey, wait a second here. Maybe I could get a shidduch between Boaz and Elim and Rus.
And she's a legendary first cousin.
Absolutely. First cousins are not a problem. In fact, uncles can marry nieces in halacha, although it's forbidden under. In fact, in many states, first cousin marriages are not allowed, but Jewish law does permit it. Now, the Ramban explains. His brother to marry the widow, and if the brother doesn't want to marry the widow, there has to be the ceremony of chalitza, in which the widow takes off the shoe from the brother, spits in front of him, and says, "So shall be done to the man who does not want to marry or rebuild his brother's home." Right? That is done to this very day. For a variety of reasons, you mentioned this before, Ashkenazim at least do not practice actual yibum today. So if a woman is in that situation, we only do chalitza. But the Torah says there's actually a choice. And now clearly, Boaz has no mitzvah of yibum towards Mahlon's widow, because Boaz is not a brother, Boaz is a cousin. Right? So there's no mitzvah, there's no commandment of yibum here. But the Ramban points out that even when there's no commandment, and there is no surviving brother, there is no person who could have that commandment, there is still an inyan of yibum, because there is an inyan meaning there's still a concept of yibum, because although the obligation is limited to brothers, any close relative can perpetuate the memory of a dead person who didn't have children by marrying the widow. So therefore, Naomi uses the word redeemer in the sense that Boaz can redeem the death of her son without child by perpetuating the memory of Mahlon. Okay? So that's the idea of Goaleinu. It is the what the Ramban calls the inyan of Yibam, the concept of Yibam, without the obligation of Yibam. Yeah,
please. But that's not even one of the cousin is even one of the seven relations.
In terms of mourning, no. First cousin is not.
So how distinct does relation go in the sense of Yibam that
you're talking about? I don't know. I would say, though, it wouldn't go further than cousin for the following reason. There is a concept that cousins are considered to be brothers on some sense, because since they are the children of brothers, they're treated as brothers. So in a sense, one could say that first cousins, because they are the direct children of brothers, are on one level are considered to be brothers in that way. But once you go beyond that, if you can't directly connect them to a brother relationship, I would say there's no union of Yibam directly. Okay, but this is Naomi's idea, which she didn't think of before. Now again, I think I had mentioned that this idea of Yibam creates tremendous problems if we learn, like Rashi learns, that Rus did not convert when she married Mahlon. According to Rashi's Shita, Rus, as well as Orpah, were non-Jews when they married Mahlon and Chilion, and Rus converted only later. Now, if Rus converted only later, that means she was never married to Mahlon. She was a goy. And if she was never married to Mahlon, there's certainly no spiritual concept of perpetuating a union. So the whole life, and Rashi does say Beferish, Rashi does say explicitly, we discussed, that Rus was a non-Jew at the time, and they committed the sin of intermarriage. So again, I don't have an answer how Rashi will interpret this idea of Yibam. I mean, maybe Rashi apparently learns it's not Yibam at all, but that'll raise just shidduch, just marriage, so to speak. But the word Goaleinu and some other things we'll see seem to point to some type of fulfillment of Yibam. But as I mentioned, the most plausible explanation for this is found in the Zohar, in which the Zohar says that Rus had converted, but there was some question whether her conversion was sincere, because maybe she did it to get a good husband, and therefore, after the husband dies, Naomi determined that her conversion was sincere. But in that case, it's not that she converted afterwards, but what she behaved, the way she behaved afterwards indicates that it was a sincere conversion all the way back from the beginning. Now, consequently, her marriage to Mahlon was a valid marriage, and therefore there would be a concept of Yibum if someone dies without children. Now, this is a far-reaching idea, because in some mystical sense, the child that is born from a Yibum marriage is not really considered the child of the Yavam. It's considered to be a child of the dead person. But it's not your child, it's your brother's child, as it were. And that's why we say by Chalitza, cursed is the man, or so shall be done to the man, who does not want to build his brother's home. It's actually based Beis Achiv. Okay. And Rus says, he also told me to stick with the men. Again, the Medrash points out that Boaz didn't say stick with the boys. Boaz said stick with the girls. So, again, this little almost slip of the tongue by Rus indicates that even in manners of speech, she was attached to the Moabite way of doing things. Again, it's kind of a subconscious Freudian slip. But the Medrash says, what do you mean? Pasuk Chaf Aleph says, he told me to stay with the Na'arim. He said, no. He said, stay with the Na'aros. Does Rashi bring that here? Rashi doesn't bring it. Okay. Yeah. And Naomi said to Rus, Kalasa. Naomi said to Rus, her daughter-in-law, Tov Biti. So Naomi also corrects Rus. She says, it is very nice, my daughter, that you will go with his women. That goes back and forth. Below Yifku Bach, and they should not entreat you to go anywhere else. And Rus followed. See, it's interesting. So Rus's speech was indelicate, but not her behavior. It says, and she attached herself to the Na'arot. Boaz, Lilaket, to continue to gather the fallen grain. Ad Kalot Kitsira Sa'orim, until the end of the barley harvest, which is around Pesach time. Ukitsir Achitim, and the wheat harvest, which is around Shavuos time. I said the whole story is between Pesach and Shavuos. Vateshev es chamosa, and she dwelt with her mother. Okay, so Perek Beis, therefore, sets up the scene of meeting Boaz, and it gives us a very detailed description of the rights of poor people in the fields and the special concessions that Boaz made, made to us. Okay, now Pasuk Gimel is the, I'm sorry, Perek Gimel is the development of the idea that was lingering in Naomi's head, right? The light bulb turned on at the end of chapter 2 when she said, ah, he is Goaleinu, he is our Redeemer. But she didn't explain what that meant. What do you mean, Redeemer? I mean, Rus may not have known what that meant at all. And at some indeterminate point, we don't know exactly when, etc., in this period between Pesach and Shavuos, Naomi is now going to flesh out the idea that Boaz should marry him.
When did Rus convert?
Well, Rashi doesn't give us an exact date, but Rashi says that the conversation that Naomi had with Rus when they're coming home from Moab to Eretz Yisrael, in which Naomi tries to discourage Rus from becoming a Jewish, that was the process of Rus converting. Now, who was the Beit Din that was there? I don't know. There's no Beis Din that is indicated, but Rashi says that was the conversion. Now the problem with that is, as I said, if that was the conversion, her marriage to Mahlon was null and void. If it was null and void, there'd be no union of Yibam. But again, as I say, we're not mechliyev to assume that according to Rashi there's Yibam here. Because as we go through the Pesukim, it doesn't say. Everyone assumes that, but all of that is assuming her marriage to Mahlon was halakhically valid. Did you want to say something? You had...
I was just going to ask, is it possible that you could just interpret that he's the Redeemer, just in the sense that they were in pretty much like abject poverty and he's wealthy and just, she could be non-Jewish.
Like. Right. Yes, in other words, you're suggesting that according to Rashi, Goaleinu is not a reference to any mitzvah of Yibam or any concept of Yibam. It just means he's our ticket out. He can help us. He can bring us back into the mainstream of society. Yeah, I think that's probably how Rashi is going to learn. Although we'll see, there'll be some other aspects of this as well. Okay. So now, Pasuk Gimel begins this. Perek Gimel. Vatomala Naomi Chamosa. Naomi, her mother-in-law, says to her, Biti, my daughter, Halo avakesh lach manoach. I will seek for you a manoach. So what's manoach? Manoach is a rest, a refuge. Asher yitav lach, that will be good to you. Ata, now, halo Boaz modatana. Boaz is our relative. Asher yis esnaim asad, we were with his young women. Hinehu, okay, let me explain this outside. She proposes a strange thing. She basically proposes what might, on some level, be called a seduction. She says to him, Boaz will be spending the night winnowing his barley crop. What is winnowing? Winnowing simply means after you thresh the crop, so the seeds are separated from the stalks, you still have pieces of straw and stubble mixed in. Mm-hmm. Right, so winnowing is kind of, you know, the wind, you throw it up, so the wind carries away the little pieces, right? Zoreh is one of the malachas of Shabbos, right? It's a form of separation, not allowed to do on Shabbos. Oh, no, this is after threshing. This is after that. Now Boaz, Naomi seems to know this, we don't know why she knows this, is Boaz will be spending the night in the silo, the gairin, the threshing floor, of the barley, in which he'll be zoreh, he'll be winnowing it. Rashi explains that Boaz, although he's very old, remember he lost 120 children as well as his wife, but Boaz will be spending the night with his crop because this was such a corrupt generation that he would sleep with his crop to be sure that it doesn't get stolen. It's like during riots, you often have storekeepers, you know, sitting in their store with their gun, you know, just to be sure, right? So Boaz essentially is sleeping with the crop to be sure it doesn't get stolen. So she knows this. So she tells us the following. You should wash yourself. We'll come back to this. Vesacht, you should smear yourself with perfume. Vesamt simlotayach alayach, put on your clothes, meaning put on nice, dress up nicely. The Arat Tagoren, and you should come down into the threshing floor, which apparently was inside a building. Al Tivadi Liish, but do not make yourself known. Ad Kaloso Lecholisha. So apparently the idea was she snuck in and she hid herself in the threshing floor. And Boaz apparently has some people there working with him. And until he finishes eating and drinking his private meal and everybody's gone, don't reveal yourself. And then it says, as he's lying down and about to fall asleep, you should make your appearance there, right? That's what she says. Now, here's a very, very interesting thing. We have, there are a lot of questions here. Does Naomi intend for Ruth to seduce Boaz? Now, it's important to keep in mind that whatever Naomi intended, the Pasuk makes very, very clear that Rus did not seduce Boaz. Rus came, Rus lay down by his feet, Rus reveals herself in the middle of the night, but there was no physical intercourse between them. And Rus did not want it. It was just proposing, as it were. So we don't know. Presumably Naomi had the same kavanah, but again, it's not a rye. Maybe Naomi thought something would happen there that indeed did not happen. But the question is, why is Naomi doing it this way at all? Again, everybody's so indirect. Boaz takes care of Ruth by giving her the right to follow the poor people instead of helping them directly. Naomi brings up the idea of Boaz being the redeemer by having Ruth show up in the middle of the night and scare Boaz half to death. And he wakes up and he says, oh, there's a woman here. You know, what's supposed to happen? Presumably the concept was that Naomi wanted to shock Boaz into a recognition that he should have had on his own. He should have realized that there's a mitzvah here, at least according to the Ramban, a mitzvah of Yibam, not a mitzvah, but the concept of a chesed of Yibam, and yet Boaz is doing nothing. Maybe he's doing nothing because it's a Moabite woman, you know, etc. And therefore, the idea of having Rus at his feet, so to speak, would shock him in a very graphic way and make him realize what his responsibilities are. At the same time, although one does not regard this as the most sinuous of ways of doing it, this would also impress on him the righteousness and purity of Rus, that she's there, but she is not trying to get any physical attention at that point. She's there just to have him understand what her duties, what his duties are, and in that way he would feel more predisposed. So the whole thing is really a way of shocking Boaz into recognizing his chiyuvim. Now there's a beautiful, beautiful thing that you can see here. That is, let me see how it is in the art scroll. Yeah, if you look, and we're in chapter 3. If you look in verse 3, so Naomi says, you should wash. By the way, Rashi records a medrash that says you should wash means you should wash off your attachment to idolatry, to Avodah Zarah. But it's not clear what that means. Even according to Rashi, that Rus was a Moabite, a non-Jew, when she married Machla, presumably Rus already had a conversion. But Rashi seems to be suggesting that she should wash herself, meaning immerse herself in a mikveh and repudiate idolatry. It almost seems that she's doing a conversion now. That's difficult. Put on a dress, etc. Then look, see, then it says v'yarat. See v'yarat, and you should go down. Now, you see the parentheses after the word v'yarat? So it says v'yaradeti, and then there's a chaf. The chaf stands for kasiv. Meaning, in Tanakh, we have words that are written one way and read another way. This is written v'yaradeti, which literally means I will go down. But it is read without that yud as if it says you will go down. The same thing in verse 4, when he lies down, you should go and uncover his feet, and you lie down. But the kasiv is v'shachav pi. Now you see, this is a very powerful idea, because what it's expressing to Rus is, you will be the one that will be going in. But everything you do, my spirit will be there with you. In other words, she's saying, don't be afraid. I know this is a very frightful thing to do, because what if Boaz rejects her? You know, Boaz might say, oh, you're a prostitute and a harlot, and you know, this might have destroyed everything. This was a very risky thing. This might have destroyed everything. And Naomi, in effect, is telling Rus, my spirit will be with you as you do each of these things. That's the Kri and the Ksiv. So the Kri is the literal. Kri is the way it's read. You will do this, you will do this. But there's a Ksiv, the way it's written is, I will be there with you. Okay. Alright, so this is what she tells Naomi, this is what Naomi tells Rus, and behold, Rus does this, she does everything. Boaz eats, he drinks, he feels good, he's about to sleep next to the grain, right, so he's sleeping outside or in the building with his gun or whatever it is, and she comes next to him, she uncovers his feet, and she lies down next to him. In a way, you know, again, on one level, it strikes us as not sinuous, on the other level, it's like the height of modesty. In other words, he's right there, and she uncovers his feet. Now, uncovering the feet is very significant, because there's a certain remez here to chalitza. It's a remez, it's an allusion. What is chalitza? Chalitza is when she takes off his shoe and spits and says, so shall be done to the man who is unwilling to build his brother's household. Boaz, so far, has been unwilling to build up Machlon's household. So what she does is, kind of a gesture, she says, she uncovers his feet, as if to say, you have not been willing yet to build your brother's home, or not your brother, your cousin's home. And therefore it's like quasi-chalitza. And she lies next to his feet, meaning she says, if you don't want me, I'll just be here. If you want me, then we can have a union. Okay, but of course, what happens is, in the middle of the night, Boaz wakes up, right? People wake up in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden they see something. And it says, he's startled. There's a woman here. What's going on? Right? So he doesn't recognize her. He says, who are you? And she says, I am Rus, your servant. And I beg of you to spread your robe, spread your wing, literally, on your maidservant. For you are the Redeemer. Okay? In fact, this is a very important phrase, lahalacha, that you see, what is the term that Rus uses for this type of marriage? Spread your garments over your maidservant. Now, in Jewish marriage, there are two parts to a Jewish marriage ceremony, which used to be separated by as much as a year. The giving of the ring, the giving of the money, that's called betrothal. That is called kiddushin, or erison. And it's not an engagement, that she's actually married from that time. But the marriage was not yet consummated. And in the time of the Gemara, there was a year. In other words, she would still live in her father's house, even though she was a married woman. At the end of the year, they would recite Sheva Brachos, and they would consummate the marriage, and then she would be a Nesu'ah. Erison and Nesu'ah. Today, we combine both at the same time. We have the giving of the ring under the chuppah, which is Kedushin. And then we have the symbolic consummation of the union, which is the yichud, where they go into a room and they're alone. That's like a symbolic consummation, which is enough. But according to some opinions, the way nesu'in, whether it's consummation, is accomplished, is by putting your garments over your wife. Now you may have seen this at Sephardic weddings. This is what they do at Sephardic weddings. The chassan wears a talit, and he drapes the talis over his wife, so they're draped under the same garments. And that is considered to be a form of a symbolic consummation of the union. And the makor, the source for that concept as effecting a consummation of union, is, according to those Rishonim, is the phrase that Rus uses to Boaz, you shall spread your wing or your garments over me. As you've seen, it's part of the, they're under the common cows. In fact, even the chuppah, according to some, the way the chuppah works is, the chuppah should belong to the chassan. Now that doesn't mean the chassan has to buy a chuppah, that would cost several hundred dollars, but technically it should be made clear lahalacha that the chassan is renting the chuppah. It shouldn't be the bride's family. Even if the bride's family is making the wedding, the chuppah should be rented by the chassan. Because part of what the chuppah does is, it is the garment of the chassan that is draped over the kala. But again, it's also interesting that Rus is echoing and mirroring the words of Boaz towards her. Because Boaz said, you know, may you find refuge in Hashem, under whose wings you have come for protection. So now she's saying, well, you described Hashem as doing that. I'm coming to you as Hashem Shaliach to spread your wings over me. But you yourself gave me that bracha. Now let's see you be the one who carries it. Who carries it out. Well, yes, you would need witnesses. But Rus is not saying Boaz should marry her now. In other words, Rus is simply telling Boaz, this is what you should do. She's not saying to do it now. In fact, he's going to do it the next day, as we're going to see. And what Rus then says is, I'm sorry, then Boaz says in verse 10, Barucha at Lashem biti, you are blessed to God, my daughter. Your last chesed is greater than the first chesed. It's very interesting. What's the first chesed? The first loving kindness is the fact that she came to Eretz Yisrael with her mother-in-law Naomi. That's a big chesed. The second chesed is that she's going to this old man Boaz to be married with him, because Boaz is now saying there's so many younger, more eligible bachelors you could have had. But the fact that you're coming to me, because this would perpetuate the memory of your mother-in-law's son, is an act of loving kindness. In other words, Boaz sees Rus's action, not as we might perceive it, as, gee, this is a lucky break to be on the gravy train for this, you know, poor Moabite woman to marry rich. But Boaz sees this for what it is, as a selfless action of loving kindness to her mother-in-law to perpetuate. Now, this concept of marrying somebody out of loving kindness, an interesting story. They tell a story about the Chafetz Chaim, that the Chafetz Chaim's father died when he was very young, and his mother remarried a man. And the man had a daughter. Now, technically, the Chafetz Chaim would be allowed to marry that girl, technically, because they didn't share common parents. The girl was from, you know, the stepfather and a woman who died. So the Chafetz Chaim was an eligible bachelor when he was young, you know, big Talmud Chacham, a brilliant Eloy, etc. So his stepfather was very interested that his daughter should marry the Chafetz Chaim. Which halachically, again, many of us look at that as incest, but it isn't. It's totally okay. Just like Woody Allen, you know. Woody Allen is allowed to marry the person that, you know, well, a guy. He's not allowed to marry a guy, but in terms of the in terms of the other aspects of it, it's not really incest. Which is, again, this is such a funny society that, you know, what raises things that, you know, don't raise any problem, you know, raise problems, and things that are problems don't raise problems. But anyway, so the thing was, the Chafetz Chaim's mother was not in favor of the shidduch. So she used to argue with her husband. She wanted a better shidduch, she wanted a richer shidduch, whatever it was. Because the point of the matter is, there'd be no economic value in that union. Meaning, in those days, like today sometimes, you know, you wanted a good dowry that would bring it in. Now, what's the point? I mean, the point is, for him to marry his stepsister, there'd be no net economic value added in that particular shidduch. But anyway, the Chafetz Chaim noticed that this issue was creating tension between his mother and his stepfather. So he just went to his mother and said, "I want to marry her. I want to marry her. This is who I want." So he married her, and he said later, it's kind of an unusual confession, that, you know, he married her only because of not to hurt his mother. And he said, and because his kavana was l'shem shamaya. Hashem blessed the shidduch with children and with learning and with mitzvahs and all of the great accomplishments the Chafetz Chaim did, because he married as an act of chesed to his mother, which is an extraordinary thing. It kind of tells you, in a way, you know, people are always obsessed, you know, am I getting my basheret, am I getting the right one, etc. It kind of indicates, you know, you make your basheret. Basheret is not just a predetermined person with whom you'll have a perfect marriage. But the concept is that you can almost marry anybody, in a sense, that if you're committed enough to make it work, and if your motivations are good, so you'll make it work, you know, you can make it work. You know, you make it work, and Hashem blesses that type of shidduch. But here we have a similar idea that Boaz is expressing to Naomi, that he says, you are willing to marry me as an act of kindness to your mother-in-law, because that is, I'm the relative that will perpetuate the soul of her son. And therefore God will bless you, because your act of loving kindness is even greater this time than it was when you came the first time to Eretz Israel. But, he says, there's a problem. We got a problem. And that is, now again, I'm going with the Ramban. Like Rashi, it's a little more difficult. Like the Ramban, we're dealing with Yibam, or quasi-Yibam, because the Ramban learns that Rus had converted, and that is, when there's Yibam, quasi-Yibam, you gotta go with the closest relative. And Elimelech and Boaz argues, there's a closer relative than I am. And that closer relative's name is Tov. Nice name, Tov, good guy. Although he's not really Tov, because I'll say Tov is his name, but Tov is not his personality. Now, what is Tov? Tov is the brother of Elimelech. So you really have three brothers here. You have Elimelech, who's dead. We have Tov. And we have Salmon. Salmon is dead, but Salmon's son is Boaz. So Boaz's relationship to Mahlon is first cousin. Tov's relationship to Mahlon is uncle. But since uncle is an actual brother of Elimelech, Tov is a brother of Elimelech, so for purposes of this quasi-Yibam, those who are in a relationship of brother to the family are considered to be closer than those who are in relationship with cousin. And therefore, the prioritization in terms of who has the right of redemption, Hibam, would lie with Tov. And therefore, Boaz says, I cannot do anything for you until I get the permission of Tov, that he waives his right to be the one that redeems him. Now this is extraordinarily from a halachic standpoint, because since this type of Yibam is not a chiyuv anyway, it's not a mitzvah, it's only an optional thing, so you might say, well, who says Tov has the right to say, you know, I want to do it? But you see that this was enough of a strong custom in Klal Yisrael that closer relatives had a right to edge out less close relatives. And therefore he says, Lini halayla, sleep here the whole night, Bahaya baboker, and it will be in the morning, Im yigalech Tov, Tov is actually a person, if Tov is willing to redeem you, Yigal, he will redeem you, V'im lo yachpots legalech, if he will not desire to redeem you, Ugal tich an anochi, then I will redeem you. Chai Hashem, by the life of Hashem, means I swear it. Shichvi ad haboker, lie here until the morning. And she lay there until the morning, etc. Of course, you see, this is because Boaz was concerned with his reputation. He says that, in other words, leave in the first thing in the morning, but leave the first thing in the morning, so nobody should think a woman spent the night in the threshing floor. Meaning, don't leave at night because it's dangerous, but don't leave 9 a.m. in the morning either because people see you walking out. No, leave at the crack of dawn where nobody's going to see. Now again, it's not that Boaz is simply covering himself, but rather there is a concept. Boaz was a gadol, after all, and one does have a responsibility not to create the impression that one is doing something wrong. The pasuk says, V'hayisem nikiyim, May Hashem and May Israel, you must be pure, not only in the eyes of God, but also in the eyes of Israel, and therefore one should avoid. That's the whole idea of Maris Ayin. I don't know if any of you ever read a book, it's a very interesting book, When Black Becomes a Rainbow. Very, very interesting story. This is written by a woman who's non-religious. She's kind of a conservative or even...